I'm Terry Thornton, and it's my great pleasure to be a part of this program. Tuesday Evenings is an ongoing series that runs through April 22nd this spring. Next week, Martin Puryear is here to talk with the Modern's chief curator, Michael Opping, about the museum's current exhibition that I hope you've seen, and if not, I hope you will see, and Puryear's long, impressive career in addition to this particular exhibition. For those of you who are planning ahead, I hate to be the bearer of bad news, but I'm sorry to announce that Kehinde Wiley is unable to make it for the April 15th Tuesday evening presentation. But the focus exhibition that features his work will still open with our Modern Till Midnight event on April 18th. And that is proving to be quite the event, with the Trimble Tech Marching Band, special tours, and other carefully considered music selections. So please check the website for details and make plans to be here. You don't want to miss out on what everybody else is going to be talking about the next week. Tonight, we are very fortunate to have artist John Stoney here to present Time and the Artist. John teaches at the University of Texas and therefore lives and works in Austin part of the year. The rest of the year, he's in New York, where his art is represented by the Kara Golden Fine Art Gallery. He received his BFA from Syracuse University in Sculpture and Film, attended St. Martin's School in London, and got an MFA from Cranbrook in Sculpture and Design. His work has been featured in important exhibitions including Field, Science, Technology, and Nature for the 2005 Armory Show at the Socrates Sculpture Park in New York, and most recently the two-person show McKendra Key and John Stoney that just closed at the Kara Golden Fine Art. John's sculptures and drawings are exquisitely executed and cleverly conceived with enormous attention to detail. Scale and material play crucial roles in works that concurrently display a high level of craft and thoughtfulness with subtle humor and irony, qualities that Ken Johnson of the New York Times referred to as delightfully surreal. Recognized for his work, John received a 2005 grant from the New York Public Arts Fund and was awarded a New York Foundation for the Arts Fellow in Sculpture in 2003. Splitting time between teaching and maintaining his successful career as an artist, time is precious, is a precious commodity for John, as it is for most of us. It's also a philosophical component of his art, so it'll be interesting tonight to see how, in fact, he addresses the issue of time in his presentation, Time and the Artist. Please join me in welcoming John Stoney.
First, I'd like to say that there's an image of me on this computer I'm looking at.
I meant to warn you.
Okay, that's gone. Whew. First, I'd like to thank Terry and the Modern for inviting me here today. And I'd like to thank you all for coming to see the artist they invited on April Fool's Day. There's a couple things I'm doing new tonight which might end up to be a complete disaster. I don't usually use notes talking about my work, but I converted to digital this time using this show as a reason to do so. And this is all new to me, so I might look a little weird, but I've got a couple buttons, and I've got text I wrote, and so bear with me. So you can go ahead and take the lights down. Owing to my never having before used notes, my talks tend to be rambling affairs with strange tangents and awkward segues with little concern for narrative arc, so I thought that by choosing a title for a presentation that had yet to be produced, it might spur me to put together a single subject lecture with texts that I would read that had a beginning, middle, and end, or at least a trajectory. Given that, you think I would have come up with a more specific title than Time and the Artist. The problem I realized last week was the word time. After all, when any word that is at one end of the hyphenated synonym for the entire universe, space, time, it pretty well guarantees that it will not help in organizing thoughts or limiting subject matter. So, bad title. But it's what I gave you, and probably for better reasons than I just spoke. Various aspects of time seem to be a unifying theme in my art, and so I've chosen work from the past 10 years that best express these connections and give some indication of how one thing follows the other. Currently, and for some time now, the aspect of time that has most interested me is what John McPhee, in his geological tour of the United States basin and range, called deep time. The time of mountains, drifting continents, evolution, and the night sky. Deep time is as difficult to conceive as is deep space. And yet today we can measure with great accuracy time and distance that would have soul-crushing relevance if our brains weren't such dim instruments for truly understanding lengths of time that exceed much more than 5 or 10 years, or distances much greater than we can drive in a day. As the writer Annie Dillard pointed out, a few years ago we were inhabitants of a good-sized galaxy with 400 billion suns like our own floating in an expanding array of 11.6 billion other similar galaxies. In a single day, when the Hubble telescope first opened its mirror to space, the universe grew to fivefold, to 52.2 billion galaxies. Today, we now know there are over 100 billion galaxies. Although these news items are well covered, nothing happened. No Earth-wide case of vertigo made us all fall to our knees, heads spinning. The universe was already too large to comfortably contemplate, and probably had been so since the first person threw a rock at the moon. The ability to perceive some things in their true physical and temporal scale, actual interrelations or comparative importance, is anathema to our brains. Trying to have a true sense of perspective in our day-to-day lives would be a painful distraction. I have made that distraction my work. Following in the tradition of American landscape painting, my work explores the scale in which we live our lives in relation to the physical and temporal scales of nature, which are empirically knowable but do not have, outside of mathematics and metaphor, expressions leading to understanding. The work inhabits the gap between what we know and what we can understand, sharing the same symbolic space as the skin of an apple-thin atmosphere of the Earth, or the human hair-thick space of time that Homo sapiens have existed on that 1,000-meter-long stretch of Earth's history. As Nixon, in a famous photo op and a view from a passing space capsule, changed forever the meaning of the vast and ancient Great Wall of China, my work looks to impose itself on the experience and meaning of my chosen subjects. The material choices for the first work I'm going to show you bear some explanation, by way of which I'm going to give you a little biography. In the early 90s, I was a Peace Corps volunteer in Togo, West Africa, which, incidentally, you may have noticed that there's another little more well-known Peace Corps veteran currently showing here. Before Togo, I had had all the desire to make art drain for me by going to art school, and had a plan of attending Woods Hole Institute for Marine Biology upon return home from Togo. But on arriving in Africa, quite without prior planning, instead of studying fish in my free time, I purchased a vacated family compound behind my hut. Wait, where's my... There it is. I purchased a family compound behind my hut, hung up a sign, Atelier de la Bêtise, and began casting bronze and aluminum and collaborating in large outdoor installations with my neighbors. This is the Atelier de la Bêtise. From the left to right, you can see the burnout kiln, furnace, and forge. And because I love these objects as objects, and they're probably the best objects I've made, I'm going to show them to you. This is the burnout kiln. That's as close to Rodin's thinker as I'm ever going to get. This is the forge, and you can notice the Gilligan Island technology bicycle wheel. So in order to build a foundry, you have to start with this in order to make tools to start building the foundry, because it's all made out of mud. Everything is just scrap and mud. This is the furnace, which was embedded with the logo, which of course was a fish, the tilapia. As any artist who has tried to give up making art will understand, there are few disciplines that are as insistent on their practitioners that they do this one thing. I'm pouring bronze here. It's 110 degrees in the shade, and I'm wearing a wool cap. Several years later, I was back in the States, suffering from culture shock, and no longer interested in casting metal, which in Africa seemed to me like a very earthy material like clay or wax. But back in the States, in the foundries, it turned back into what it was, a very loaded art material. A bronze sculpture, no matter what it depicts, always has the added burden of being a bronze sculpture. So partly, out of respect for reciprocity, I started using a material that I learned to use in Africa, dung. Dung, specifically cow dung, is the acme of reductive materials. You simply can't make anything out of it that is not, in its essence, shit. Like bronze, manure doesn't allow you to change the subject. And here, I sided with Bertolt Brecht, who thought America was a cow, and against Joseph Beuys, who thought it a coyote. This is the problem with airplanes. Both the plane and the cloud are dung straight from the field. And I want to mention this. The problem is, of course, it's going down. I state the obvious because there was a review in Time Out, I remember, that the critic said it was an environmental statement about air pollution. And yeah. The first pieces that I'm showing you all share a common aspect of time. They're all moments frozen out of time, where the before and after weren't really invited into the conversation. An interesting side note here is I'm using manure to represent the lowest of materials, but the notion that animal waste, is a waste product is relatively modern and very Western. Not only is manure valued fuel and fertilizer, but as a building material, it rivals cement for a large part of the world's population. A Swiss artist named Nat Vital did a series of work about just this thing about the same time I was making these things. He cast he cast bronze replicas of cow patties in India where he was traveling. He sold them to his well-heeled clients back in Europe, and with the proceeds, he built burn units in local community hospitals in India, proving that he's a better person, if not a better artist, than myself. This is Romance of the Sea, where a small model of the Queen Mary is sinking in the corner of a rolling sea. Since this piece was begun before the movie Titanic was released, I can only guess that the imagery comes from a much older source and a better told tale, the last line of Moby Dick. Now small fowls flew screaming over the yet yawning gulf. A sullen white surf beat against its steep sides, then all collapsed, and the great shroud of the sea rolled on as it rolled 5,000 years ago. This is called The Spirit of Transportation, and it's after a Maxfield Parrish painting of the same name that I loved when I was a child. The painting is a paean to the mastery of nature and the inevitability of progress. When you first see the painting, the scene is a feral landscape with a wild river running below trees and a rocky cliff. But just barely emerging out of the cliff is a truck barreling across a narrow cut in the face of the rock. With my more critical grown-up eyes, I changed the emphasis. As you can see, the break in the guardrail and the truck plummeting into the river. I would say everything since the airplane, all these pieces that you've seen since the airplane piece, they're not 100% cow manure. I found it with the airplane piece from picking up manure off of the farm and slapping it into my molds. It took about 6 weeks for it to dry, and you'd end up with something that's very light and papery, but it literally takes 6-7 weeks with a hairdryer blowing 24 hours a day to dry. So I dried it. I pre-dried the dung and ground it up and mixed it with plastic and got the point across still. It's still 80% dung, but it had the color and the effect. So This is Adventures into the Unknown. A plane and a rocket share the same plume of smoke, the one going down and the latter going up. Several years after I made my last dung piece, the London artist Chris O'Feely had a painting, The Holy Virgin Mary, which was adorned with elephant manure, exhibited at the Brooklyn Museum of Art. Then Mayor Giuliani used the opportunity to sue the Brooklyn Museum because he didn't want to fund it anymore on behalf of his shock constituents, none which we could actually find. I, being a manure expert, sprang into action and made a small but very fetching bust of the mayor and gave it as a gift of solidarity to the director of the Brooklyn Museum, for which I got a free tour of the show. The mayor was sitting on a pedestal. The pedestal said, "Hosanna." All the work from this time was not dung. This one is called The Great Wall of China. In the late 60s and early 70s, the meaning of the Great Wall of China, which used to be a monument to persistent tyrannical power and extreme xenophobia, was forever changed by two events: Nixon's walking it in a Life magazine photo op, and an American astronaut seeing it from orbit. This is a scale model of an ordinary 6-mile-high cumulonimbus storm cloud passing over the Great Wall, imposing its own definition of what the wall signifies. It's 13 feet tall and about 9 feet in diameter. Interestingly enough, in 2003, in a bid to take back the Great Wall of China, the first Chinese astronaut, despite his efforts, failed to see it. Clouds kept it covered. Aside from whatever else these pieces were doing, they were the beginning of this idea that runs through all my work, that despite where we think we are or how well we are doing, nature has a way of continually reasserting dominance over the meaning of things. In 1999, I moved to my ancestral hometown of New York. Both of my parents are Queens and Brooklyn children, born and raised, but I had never actually lived in the city. I had never lived there, and perhaps to familiarize myself with the city, I decided to make a model of it. This is called a cross-section of the North American continental plate. It's a scale model about 5.5 feet square, depicting a 14-mile deep cross-section of the Earth's crust that Manhattan is built upon. In Manhattan, every building is carved out of a 1-inch plank of pine at a scale of 1,250 feet to an inch, making the Empire State Building 1 inch tall and everything else underneath it, except for the Twin Towers, which were a little bit taller. This is based on John McPhee's observation in Annals of a Former World that Lower Manhattan's characteristic saddle shape, where the giant buildings of downtown make way to low-rising buildings to the north until the giants return again in the 30s, was not so much determined by civic or economic planning, but rather the ancient rocks on which the city was built. Starting 500 million years ago, an Ocean volcanic mountain chain collided with the northeastern U.S., creating the Taconic Mountains, the roots of which inspired the first American art movement, the Hudson River School, and the topography of New York City, and by extension, the world's modern cityscapes. Finishing off the design of the city about 12,000 years ago, the Laurentide ice sheet, which covered most of North America, retreated, filling the space between downtown and uptown with rubble, and building along its terminal moraine, Long Island, as well as Nantucket and Cape Cod, out of pieces of Canada, New Jersey, and lands between. This is downtown. You can see that it was finished before 2001. It was finished in 2000, and it's the last model of New York with this particular skyline. Not that too many models of Manhattan were ever made, but that's Midtown. You can barely make out the Empire State Building. And right in front is the Secretariat, the UN, my favorite building in New York. This is the first piece where geological time becomes a major issue. This is also where I mention a third aspect of time that this piece in particular illustrates. A lot of the work I choose to do requires an absurd amount of time. Usually, and fortunately for the work, the expression of those hours is physically apparent in the materials and a big part of the aesthetic. So for the next piece, I decided to do a scale model of the universe. I have a I have to preface this, though, with a current event, because it was just really cool and it belongs here. It was a news item from about 12 days ago. Early in the morning on March 19th, 2008, to the left of the Big Dipper in the constellation Bootes, the news of a vast explosion known as a gamma ray burst came in the form of a new star coming into the range of sight of the unaided eye, and then, in a few hours, faded away again. That explosion, whether it was the implosion of a massive star into a black hole or something equally as strange and powerful, that event happened 7 billion years ago. So whoever may have been looking at that part of the night sky at that time of night, their naked eyes would have been bathed in a light that begun its journey 2 billion years before our sun was born. This is the universe, or at least a quarter of it, viewed from a wintry New England landscape facing north, 12 midnight, sometime in January. The stars are some 2,000 fiber optic hairs of various sizes corresponding to the magnitude of stars, embedded in a 52-inch half dome. The red supergiant star, Betelgeuse, is the left shoulder of the constellation Orion. It's the only star we can see with our naked eyes that is in its last stages of life. It's dying. We are the only ones who know this, and we are the only ones who know its name. And the piece is called Betelgeuse Dying So Far From Home. Closer to home, this is how high a man can jump on the moon. It's a 9-foot diameter scale model. Well, they're all scale models. Of a particular section of the moon. My father is a rocket scientist. He was one of the chief engineers of the manned space program. And when I was a kid, to me, the single most important part of that awesome technological achievement, the reason we spent all that energy getting to the moon was because it would be really cool to jump about weighing 1/6 of what you do on Earth. Returning to Earth, many of the astronauts admitted to feeling the same way. Walking on the moon was like being a child again. And if you remember watching them hopping about on the moon, what you didn't see was them falling, which they did very frequently. Those videos were never shown to us. But all they had to do to stand up was push, and they popped back up again. So it was like falling as a child. Coming closer to Earth, this is called You Can't Go Home Again. It's a 10-foot long, pathologically accurate scale model of the American side of Niagara Falls. And Moby Dick, as he would find himself if, escaping from his New England captor, he tried to swim via the St. Lawrence Seaway and the Northwest Passage back to his Pacific home. It is my attempt to deal with the argument and central theme to Melville's masterpiece. Is meaning inherent in nature, or is it imposed? And I feel that this piece pretty much answers that question. Here's a detail of Bridal Veil Falls. And I think this is a good place to bring up the issue of the way I'm describing this work to you. Almost nothing of what I say about this piece or most any of my other pieces was really known to me while I was making them. The words come after the sculpture, after the sculpture is finished, for the most part. Most of my work comes to me in an image already complete, but with no words. And usually I'm half asleep. At this point in the process, I already know what it's going to look like. I just have no idea why. That all comes later. This is untitled, as it should be, as you can see. It's a 6-foot scale model of the Empire State Building, and it's made of paper. It's made over 10,000, well over 10,000 pieces of embossed paper, printing paper. I cast the building details in bronze stamps, pressing each piece by hand with the 2-ton arbor press, and again by hand cut them out and pasted them together. And yeah, the underside that you can't see is as finished as the rest. If you want a sure way of getting on a Homeland Security watch list, call the New York City Planning Department a few years after 9/11 and ask if they happen to have the blueprints of the Empire State Building. Which I did, and I can't believe I'm still able to fly. This piece came into my head at the same time, the same morning, as Niagara. They popped up together. I was just waking up, and I puzzled over why this should be for a long time. Until one day, sitting in traffic, my conscious mind noticed something that my subconscious had known for a long time. So, much to my embarrassment, I had just spent a year and a half making the New York State license plate. At about the same time, around 2004, I had another model landscape in my head, like Niagara, but of a section of Yellowstone, with Old Faithful in the middle, streaming and erupting. When an opportunity for funding came up for an outdoor piece at Socrates Sculpture Park on the East River in Queens. This is the park that Mark DeSouvre founded and where he still keeps a studio. So I scaled it up a little. This is called Remember Me. It is a sympathetic scale model of Old Faithful Geyser. By sympathetic, I mean that every time Old Faithful erupts in Wyoming, it simultaneously triggers the model's eruption sequence in New York. Hidden in 120 feet into the woods is a weatherproof box with a fountain control and computer attached to the internet. The computer scans the Old Faithful webcam for signs of an eruption, and 18 to 21 times a day, it sees one and triggers mine. This is the fumarole. There's a 300-gallon tank of water underground, and like Old Faithful, when it's not erupting, it smokes. Funny story, when I was given this project, I had only 6 weeks to figure out how to build it, and I needed to get images of Old Faithful's fumarole because I don't make anything up. I have to copy it from something. So I called the park up to make reservations, only to discover that they were closed, and they closed for only 2 weeks of the year for mating season. This is what's on the computer screen in the woods. In the 80s, a geologist, long curious why no calderas or craters, the kind left by the type of volcano Yellowstone is, could be found in the park. Studying NASA survey maps of the Yellowstone region, he discovered why. The whole park was the caldera. Yellowstone sits on top of one of the largest volcanoes in the world, what we now call a supervolcano. And in further study, we have learned that it erupts, taking most of the Midwest with it every 600,000 years. The last eruption was 640,000 years ago. So we are overdue for a lesson on the meaning of things. Last year, I had to revisit a motif that apparently wasn't finished with me. This is a view from West Point. It's about 4.5 feet tall, a little smaller than the previous one. The model of the 6-foot-high cumulonimbus storm cloud was carved out with a dental tool, just using a small dental tool. The landscape was carved by a computer using topographical information from the U.S. Geological Survey digital topographical mapping of North America done in 2000 from the space shuttle. It is a three-dimensional representation of a very popular painting from the 19th century. The view from the center front of this was exactly where many 19th century painters stood while visiting West Point. As with all my work, it is a change in perspective that shifts the meaning of the subject, layering and sometimes obscuring the collective understanding of, in this case, a place. The landscape is seen from the middle ground between the earthbound and outer space, between the romantic and scientific representations. Since the view facing north starts on the battery that juts out of the north side of the U.S. Military Academy that owes its name to the geographical location, the school itself is entirely cut out of the picture. The geographical West Point looks just as it does now, 12,000 years before the Military Academy and its attendant philosophies existed, and will be recognizable as the same landscape 12,000 years after the Academy has gone. This was a very popular view. These aren't all of the pictures I collected. But you can see nothing's changed since then. I also draw, but I've never included any drawings in my presentations before, mostly because they speak well enough for themselves and I don't have that much to say about them. But I wanted to show you these three because they came out of a trip I made last July to the Petrified Forest in Arizona to do these next few sculptures that I'm going to show you. I came upon a pine and birch forest that had burned within the past few years, and these trees, some dead, some still living, were talking to me, literally. They had words on them, and I thought, my sentiments exactly. This is Todd and Billy forever. The drawings are all colored pencil on rag. They're 30 inches by 22. Detail. Todd. This is Mark and Lane, 88. This was one of the dead ones. And this is called Cool with an exclamation mark. This is actually one of the trees that had survived. The petrification of wood is still not well understood, but it is one of the more spectacular examples of fossilization, the Earth's way of making copies and preserving the memories of past life. Aside from their crystalline beauty, it is the great antiquity that make them popular objects of contemplation. Like standing at the edge of a Grand Canyon or the foot of Niagara Falls, fossils have the power to disillusion the ego, giving entree into a world not as we make it, but as it is. Awesome, capricious, and blind to our hopes and wishes. This is called The Sword and the Stone. It's a 15.5-million-year-old petrified ginkgo stump from Utah, and it sits atop a rocky berm, which provides the setting for a cocktail sword. A comment on the ephemerality of contemporary structures of power. Making a mold of dirt was something new, and I don't suggest trying that. It doesn't work very well. This is called Green Party Paleontology, or the principle of original horizontality. It's a 17-million-year-old petrified log recast from stone into mahogany, resting on felt. And it is, of course, a rather pessimistic take on Joseph Beuys and social activism in general, but with great love for both. One of the interesting things about casting petrified logs is that what you're left with when you cast a log is something that looks a lot like a log. And everything about petrification, all the beauty, the rock, the crystalline, the magic is gone. It just looks like a log. Not that I didn't think that was going to happen, but along with Patch of Weeds, Durer's Field Hare was one of the first examples of a nature study that in its single-minded concentration on the thing itself, in this case a young hare in repose, did not rely on metaphor, allegory, or doctrine for conveyance of meaning. Also conspicuously absent is God. The portrait did not exalt the creator of the hare, but rather the hare itself. The rabbit was the message. Durer was my introduction into art and the backbone of my artistic education until college. In college, Joseph Beuys was how I found entree into understanding of conceptual art. This image is from a famous performance from 1965, How to Explain Pictures to a Dead Hare, in which Beuys walked about the Schmeller Gallery in Düsseldorf, face coated in honey and gold leaf, talking softly to a dead hare. And last year, at about this time, having no notion that I would soon be spending 4 months casting petrified trees, I was wandering about the mineral collection at the American Museum of Natural History in New York, and looking at a petrified stump that I had seen literally over 100 times before. But this time on it sat a 16th century German hare. And it was covered with gold leaf. And this is called Explaining Time to a Dead Hare. The hare sits on a 225 million-year-old petrified tree, Ara Eucari Oxalon Arizonicum, which happens to be the state rock of Arizona. I think of this piece now as my unified field theory of my aesthetics. But in the Natural History Museum that day, I wasn't aware of why or how these things belonged together. They just did. I will end this talk as it was started with two quotes. The first is from Byron's Don Juan. I'll take a drink of water first. But let it go. It will one day be found where other relics of a former world, when this world shall be former, underground, thrown topsy-turvy, twisted, crisped, and curled, baked, fried, or burnt, turned inside out or drowned, like all the worlds before, which have been hurled first out of and then back again to chaos, the superstratum which will overlay us. The second, from Chelsea Weathers, an art historian at UT who recently wrote about my work. In Alfred Hitchcock's film Vertigo, Jimmy Stewart and Kim Novak find themselves in a sequoia forest. At a display of a cross-section of a tree trunk where historical events spanning a range of over 1,000 years have been marked according to their corresponding rings on the trees, on the tree, the Dais Novak raises her hand and touches two places on the trunk, barely an inch apart, and says, "Somewhere in here I was born, and there I died. It was only a moment for you. You took no notice." Thank you. Any questions? We have time.
I noticed your affinity for or deafness for scale, and I'm wondering, as a student, as a young person in college, did you have or do you now have some sort of affinity or mathematical ease with mathematics? It seems to me that would be almost necessary, but I'm just curious.
None. Something currently being studied in mathematics is dead reckoning. I'm able to, I have to actually figure out the formulas I learned in high school every single time I come upon the need for them again. So if I have to make something round, I have to pretty much figure out how to, the math from scratch.
Your ability to conceptualize Bill-Hermian scale is just, I guess, innate. It doesn't have any correlation to mathematical...
None at all. No, my sister's an architect. I actually call her up for anything more complicated than circles. And my father being a rocket scientist, that doesn't help much either. Something I have to say about that. I mention he's a rocket scientist now because I didn't when I was a kid, because I didn't know he was a rocket scientist. I thought he was an aerospace engineer. And I didn't know that rocket scientist and aerospace engineer were the same thing until well past the time that it would have done me any good to know this, like grade school. I found out in college when I was describing what my dad did. He's an aerospace engineer. And when some friend of mine said, "Oh, he's a rocket scientist." And I, wow, that's a lot of... It could have helped me a lot in school.
What was the material for the waterfall? How did you make it?
A lot of the white things that you saw were made of a material called aqua resin, which is plastic that it's called polymerized gypsum, and it's non-toxic, and which is why I use it. It's also because it's got this nice fleshy... Excuse me, I'm trying to restart this thing to show you. It's also got this really nice texture to it, and I use the material for itself. I don't paint it. Here we go. Yeah, I don't paint it. This is why a lot of the work, in fact, all the work that I do, I don't paint usually. It's I think I dyed one of the logs recently, and that was the sword and the stone piece. Those are all made of this aqua resin material. It's a material you lay up just like any other plastic with fiberglass, and the falls are made. And most of the things I make are made with plasticine first. So it's traditional method of carving oil clay. So I layer and then carve away and layer and carve away. And most everything is, like I said earlier in the talk, made with a dental tool, about that big. It's what I find most convenient to work with, and which also means that every single mark on the piece is visible. You know that my finger passed by that area. They're very small little details. Oh, and then I take a rubber mold off of the plasticine. So it's a big rubber blanket mold, and then I put the plastic material in the rubber mold.
What kind of activities interested you as a child?
Astronomy. photography. Actually, I got into photography because of astronomy, because I wanted to take pictures of stars. And things that you do alone. Building model airplanes, balsa wood airplanes, that kind of thing. I never got into rocketry, oddly enough. I also had this really strange preoccupation when I was very young, and I don't know why because my mother had three kids before me and she'd given up by me, but she let me boil hot wax on our stove and dip my hand in it when I was 10. And I would dip my hand in wax and build up a big mold of wax around my hand. Pulling up my hand, I'd pour plaster Paris in it and pick apart the wax and have this beautiful casting in my hand. I did literally dozens of these between the ages like 8 and 10. And I just kept doing it. Strange, but yeah. I'd gone to school for photography. Like I said, I got into photography through looking at the stars. And when I arrived in school, I was going to become a photographer. I was going to become either a fashion photographer or a photojournalist. I went to the Newhouse School at Syracuse. That's why I ended up at Syracuse for sculpture, because the first year I was there, I thought, I don't want to be a fashion photographer, and I got scared and went to sculpture. I took a class in sculpture, and I just fell in love with it. I thought, wow, it's like casting hands. And so I made that connection. I should be doing this. Anybody else? Okay, thank you very much.